You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, modern scientists are using age-old climate data that are hundreds of years old. We talk with a UW scientist about how it's benefited his research. First, if you're looking to hire people for your business, it might seem natural to go for people that you know and that you like, but a social relationship can make managing an employee difficult, and it can cause problems with people who work for you who aren't in the friend circle. Well, we want to hear about your experiences working with your friends, being the boss maybe of a friend, at 800-642-1234. Have you ever hired a friend or ended up working for a friend? Did it change your relationship, and would you do it again? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, our next guest has some specific advice for what to consider before offering that friend a job. Tom Scriver teaches entrepreneurship at the Johnson School at Cornell University. And Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. Well,
great.
First of all, is it always a bad idea to hire somebody who's your friend?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. Sometimes it can be very valuable to have somebody who knows you well, knows what you're good at, knows what you're not good at. And sometimes you need that person on your team who's willing to say when the emperor has no clothes.
And so how do you assess whether it's going to be a good thing to have that friend on board or it's going to cause problems down the road?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no easy way or a simple litmus test. I think the first thing that you need to be really thinking about is the fact that no matter how much you might hope or intend for the relationship to go well while you're working together, there's always a chance that it doesn't. Just like people who get married always think they're going to be together for life, but then, you know, a lot of marriages do end in divorce. You have to think ahead about what that might be like. So my first advice for people who are thinking about working together is not to enter into that work relationship unless you're willing to take the risk that it might end your friendship as well. And so I think kind of being upfront about that with each other and saying, look, you know, this might go badly, and what does it mean if it does? And if you're not willing to have that conversation just as openly as I just said it, then that's probably a good sign that it might be better to pass.
So if we did decide to hire that friend, what do they need to know? So part of it is on us because we're the person who's hiring them. In a way, we'll be the responsible party. But what should you do if you're the friend who's considering that job?
Yeah, so it's actually the same kind of things that you would do taking any job with one or two additional components. So the thing that I would tell anybody who's taking a job is to say, understand really, really well what that enterprise that you're about to join, that organization you're about to join, what are they about? What's their mission? What's their vision? How do they create value? Who are they doing it for? What kind of problems do they solve? And where does your role that you're about to take fit into that? What is your part of that machine? Where do you fit? And I don't just mean from the point of view of, you know, Steve reports to Sally who reports to Joe, but really how does your role kind of work in that chain of creating value for the customers or people who are served by that organization? So that's advice I think that's true for anybody regardless of where they're going. When it comes to the friend relationship, it really takes an extra level to make sure that you understand that extremely well, because if you do have a friend relationship with somebody, kind of recorrecting them, if you will, and that process of saying, hey, you know what, you're not kind of integrating with the company exactly right, you know, the stakes get a little bit higher. You want to start on the right foot. The other thing that I think is really critically important about the relationship piece is having an upfront conversation to say, okay, you know, you and I are friends outside of work. We might go to a ball game together or hang out together, and we'll act a particular way in that context. Maybe we'll tease each other or have, you know, some form of banter. Is that okay in a work setting or isn't it? How do I deal with you when I'm around coworkers that's different than how I might deal with you when we're at friends or at a college reunion?
Let's take a caller now as we talk to Tom Scriver, talking about when it's okay to hire a friend. He says if you're going to do it, you really have to think carefully about it. He's got some very specific advice for what to do when you're considering hiring that friend. And also, if you're the friend who's looking for a job from a friend, What do you need to do to protect yourself? Well, you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can always post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to a caller now. We've got Kat on the line with us in Madison. Kat, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
What did... Well, I just want to weigh in. I've been a store manager for probably 8 years, and I have hired people that are friends. I've rehired people that used to work there before I took over, and I've had nothing but negative experiences personally with laying down the law, you know, and just saying, hey, you didn't follow the rules that apply to everyone else, so now you're getting written up. And I've had people say, well, I thought we were friends, and if you proceed with this write-up, I'm going to walk out. And I've had to say, well, I can't treat you any differently, and that's the way that it is. So I now really avoid that in general, and if I do get close to someone at work, it's only after they've worked for me for about a year or two, so I can make sure that level of respect has already been built up.
So, Kat, it sounds like you have lost friendships because of this situation.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, it's happened to me twice, and, you know, probably in my first year or two of management, and I've sworn off of it. I've had people I know, even casual acquaintances, say, oh, can I work for you? And now I say, nope. If I've had even one drink with you outside of work, you cannot work for me.
Kat, thanks a lot for that perspective. Kat has had nothing but negative experiences from it. And one thing that comes up there is, you know, if you do hire a friend, let's say maybe they sneak through those filters you want us to try, Tom, but they get a job with us and it doesn't work out. I mean, should you be prepared to lose the friendship walking into that arrangement? Should you know that that is something that could happen?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you have to be very comfortable with that eventuality. And like I said before, you don't go in hoping that that's going to happen. You hope that won't happen. But the alternatives are these, and I think the caller did a great job of laying it out. Either you let go of that friend who's not performing, or you lose the respect of everybody else in the organization. All it takes is one instance where there's clear feeling of kind of nepotism or favoritism, and then that person who isn't your friend, who might be well-performing, is going to say, this isn't a level playing field. I should go take my talent somewhere else. So if you want to create a fair organization where you get the best out of everybody, you need to show very actively that you're putting everybody on an even playing field, whether or not they have a social relationship with you or not.
Kat, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing your story. And we're going to go next to Jean, joining us in Clintonville. Hi, Jean.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
My situation is a little bit different. I work in a big clinic, and my daughter is the supervisor. And when I found out that she got the job, we both sat together and we agreed that when I'm in the building, she is the boss. I'm just another worker, you know, getting through the day. But when I get out of the building, I'm mom. And we've been doing this for over 6 years and it's been working out fine.
Oh, that...
We even live next door to each other.
So it sounds like you two have a very healthy relationship, some healthy boundaries there at work, too. And that's an interesting one, a family relationship. Thanks a lot, Jean, for sharing your story. What do you think about that, Tom?
Yeah, family businesses are a just tremendous and interesting area of themselves. And I think this is an interesting example of when you have a little kind of microcosm of a family business inside an existing one. That intergenerational interplay, boy, I got to say, just like you did, it sounds like they have a great relationship with each other. You know, I love my mom, but boy, I can't imagine trying to replicate that myself. I don't think it would work very well. So it's a great example of there's no single rule for everybody. That upfront boundary setting, I think, must have been so tremendously important. The fact that they sat down and had that honest conversation to start to say, this is how we're going to be together at work, and this is how we're going to be together at home, and they can be different. And I think if they weren't willing to have that conversation, I would have guessed that it would have been a different outcome.
What do you think about husbands and wives working in the same workplace? Is that something that you think you can apply these same rules to and maybe get a healthy outcome?
Yeah, I think for most of the people that I know, and I would put myself in this category with my wife as well, you know, I don't think that I think we're better as a couple at home, and I think it's good for us to have a little bit of distance. I know people who do work together as husbands and wives, and have made a success of that. The most frequent scenario, though, is where you have people who have very clearly different skill sets. So, for example, you know, maybe the wife is a landscape architect and the husband is somebody who's good at business management and operations. And so the husband's out there, you know, selling clients, and then the wife is doing the landscape design and the work that is truly her space. And so, you know, getting back to that word we just used, boundaries, those boundaries are really clear. And I think those are the instances where I've seen that situation work the best and in the most healthy way.
Tom, we leave it there. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
You bet. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Tom Scriver. He teaches entrepreneurship at the Johnson School at Cornell University, and he runs business incubation programs at Cornell and in the Ithaca community. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, climate data has been kept for many centuries around the world, and we'll find out why those records are still valuable today. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Open a bottle from the Old Castle Soda Company in Whitefish Bay and discover the story of resorts and urbanization in early 20th century Wisconsin. Kelsey Corrigan has the story as part of our ongoing series, Wisconsin 101, a statewide collaborative project to explore Wisconsin's story through historical objects.
This object is a soda bottle made from the Sea Castle Soda Company from Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin in the early 1900s. And this soda bottle contained carbonated water mostly and was sold to people in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. The Castle Soda Bottle Company started in 1897, and they just made carbonated water, which was called soda water back then. And they were in Whitefish Bay. It was a very local business, and they really didn't sell any soda outside of Whitefish Bay. Whitefish Bay at the time hadn't really developed yet. It was mostly farms, not a lot of houses really, but there's a big resort there. It was called the Whitefish Bay Pabst Resort. It attracted a ton of people every weekend from all over Wisconsin and from northern Illinois. It even attracted famous people. I believe President Theodore Roosevelt went there at one point. It was very highly regarded in Wisconsin. So Pabst actually started the resort. He built it in the purpose to sell more Pabst products. And so they only sold alcoholic beverages because that's what Pabst made. And that's where the Castle Soda Company came in, is they provided the non-alcoholic beverages. So the soda company really relied on the Whitefish Bay Pabst Resort, and that's how it was able to stay in business for about 20 years. I am originally from Whitefish Bay, and so when I started to research objects for this project, I kind of looking for an object that was from my hometown because that interests me, and it was a way for me to learn more about where I grew up. But what I thought was really cool about the soda company is that there was a diary entry that I read about a young girl who actually wrote that the Castle Soda Company, if you found their empty soda bottles throughout Whitefish Bay or throughout the resort and you returned it to the Castle Company, you got a free soda. So I thought that was just the coolest story, and I researched more into it, and it turns out that glass soda bottles were very expensive at the time, so bottle reuse was becoming more common in the early 1900s because of the expense of importing soda bottles and embossing company names on soda bottles. So I thought Castle made a very unique and innovative way to kind of keep its bottles by giving out free soda if you return the bottle. It's funny. I remember growing up, and I remember seeing actually Castle's house. It was a huge house that was on the main downtown block in Whitefish Bay, and I definitely remember it was a huge house. And it's a shame now the house is torn down, but it was really cool for me to kind of think back and know that this house at one time, 100 years ago, was making soda and was contributing to Whitefish Bay's development. Which is crazy that I live in Whitefish Bay and I never knew there was this big resort and this soda company there.
That story is part of Wisconsin 101, a collaborative project to explore our history in objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the concept of climate change and climate science may seem new, but in fact, people around the world have been gathering data and recording environmental milestones and climate patterns for many centuries, and their reasons for doing so were sometimes economic and sometimes religious. One scientist using that old data is John Magnuson. He's director emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Limnology. And John, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
So can you tell us about some of these hundreds of years old examples of climate science that you're using now, this data?
Well, there are two records that are really quite unique in terms of their length of human observation of a ice date, like a breakup of a river or a freeze of a lake. And one is a lake in Japan, Lake Suwa. And it's a religious record that was begun in 1443 and continues to the present time. The second record is a torn river in the border between Sweden and Finland, and that was begun in 1693 and continued to the present time. So these two records, one has almost 600 years of data and the other 300. The people who did this were not climate scientists. I'm sure the climate science was not even in their thought processes, but they've been very useful for analyzing direct observations of two variables that are greatly correlated with climate and climate variability.
So taking that example of the Japanese lake and the ice ridges on Lake Suwa, you said it was, why would someone have been keeping track of that for hundreds of years?
Well, it's a Shinto tradition, and the Shinto tradition, the story is that there's a male shrine on one side of the lake and a female shrine on the other, and the male god would, when ice formed on the lake, would walk across the lake, and it formed ice ridges, which we see on our lakes all the time, but they called them Omowatari, and they thought they were evidence that the male god had gone to visit the female god, and they had a ceremony, a religious ceremony on the lake. Now, you have to remember that in 1443, Columbus had not yet discovered America. The Gutenberg Bible hadn't been published yet. And so religious traditions and beliefs were very dominant and used to explain natural phenomena around them.
And then looking at the Finland example you were talking about, the breakup of the river ice in Finland, what have we learned about that?
Well, that record goes for about 320 years. And it was a record was originally started for essentially economic reasons, desire to know when you can move across the ice for things like that and catch fish. And it has been maintained by the people who live in the valley of that river. Actually, it's been maintained by people on both sides of the valley. One side is Sweden, the other side is Finland.
And how did you first find out about these? These can't be things that you would be able to easily access by Googling them, for example.
Well, if you Google them today, you'd find some wonderful blogs that were written after we published a paper in Nature Scientific Reports recently on these two lakes. In the 1990s, I received money from the National Science Foundation to have and call together scientists from around the world that had been studying ice seasonality on lakes and rivers. And we published a large number of papers on that, but the records were typically 150 to 160 or so years old. And one of those lakes is our own Lake Mendota. But in the record were these two really old records, you know, centuries longer records. And they really caught my attention because, first of all, both began before the onset of the Industrial Revolution. So we had direct observations by people before the Industrial Revolution and after the Industrial Revolution in both systems. And so it seemed to me a really unique, almost serendipitous resource to try to figure out what direct observation tell us about historic climates.
And what have you found? You've looked at this data, and obviously with an eye to climate change and what's changed between these records in the early years and now, and what did you find?
Well, one of the things that we had anticipated and was clear as a bell, and that is that the rate of change and the loss of ice states and ice cover were greater after the start of the Industrial Revolution than before. And for Lake Sewell, it was very dramatic. After the Industrial Revolution began, there were 24 times faster than before the start of the Industrial Revolution. In the Finnish River, we were only twice as fast, but in both cases, they were clearly faster after the start of the Industrial Revolution. And the key is that they were based on direct human observation rather than inferred from other kinds of information.
So you're marking the Industrial Revolution as when things accelerated. I think of climate change as something that is more recent than that. Why do you think it started then?
Well, the science of climate and climate change is that the warming is caused by an increase in carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas in our atmosphere. And when the Industrial Revolution began, we started to use a carbon-based economy and burn more coal, and now oil and natural gas. And so it actually had its roots much earlier than the recent thoughts and talk about it that's been so prevalent over the last 50 years.
So is this an example about why it's important to keep records?
Well, it is. And there's a counterpart to those kind of records today, what you might call citizen science. A lot of people that live around a lake or along a river are now interacting through our Department of Natural Resources with the state and making observations on that lake over time. And they will, as time unfolds, with the citizen science, discover whether the lake is warming. They will discover whether the lake is getting greener. And so human observations are still very valuable and can be very useful for people who live on and are trying to make decisions about the use of water.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was John Magnuson, Director Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Limnology. He joined us to talk about the age-old climate data that's informing his study of climate change today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Snap Judgment. Tonight, a look at what happens when you feel disaster looming, but still you decide to go for it. That's tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network. First, the tragic story of a UW-Madison student dying abroad has started a larger conversation about safety for other study abroad students. Bo Solomon was from Spring Green, Wisconsin, and died shortly after beginning his program of study in Rome. Officials in the city say they suspect foul play in his death. Our next guest is an advocate for more education for students who study abroad. She's the founder of the group Depart Smart, whose mission is to protect students abroad by providing safety information. And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. You can call in and share your study abroad experiences. Have you ever been in an unsafe situation on foreign soil? And what safety information do you gather before you travel internationally? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Cheryl Hill is with us now. She's the executive director and founder of Depart Smart. Cheryl, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having us.
Well, what was your reaction to the news that Bo Solomon from here in Wisconsin died in Rome over the weekend?
My first response was, oh, no, not another one, not again. He's not the first student to go on pub crawls in the Campo di Fiore, and it's across the Tiber from John Cabot, John Durkin, Andrew Magni. There have been a number of other students who lost their lives similarly.
And we know that thousands of students study abroad every year, so what is the message here? We hear these stories. Some of them hit close to home, like Bo Solomon. Some we may not have heard of, but there are lives lost. So what is the takeaway for studying abroad?
I think that, you know, I'm also the mother of a young man who died full of his future on a student abroad program. He was a sophomore in college going into his junior year, and he died on a people-to-people program in Japan in 2007. As a host mom of more than 8 kids for 12 years, I get how awesome it should be, and we all want to give these young people the world and see them come back full of their future and with cultural understandings and broadening their horizons in the most amazing ways. But I was stupefied to discover that not one department of the United States of America has any jurisdiction to stop the victimization of our children on school-sponsored academic athletic programs in foreign countries. Policy has not kept pace with globalization. There is no prerequisites, no duty of care, no mandated duty to inform when schools mandate study abroad to earn degrees.
First of all, I'm so sorry that you lost your son, Cheryl, and taking up some of the points you made about there being a lack of jurisdiction, how would that play out if a student goes abroad to study about the gaps that you see in safety there?
Well, let's take, for an example, what happens here at home. Here at home, we have laws like Title IX and the Victims Against Women's Act, VAWA, and even CLERI for campus safety reporting. If you wanted to know the Campus Safety and Security Report of the University of Wisconsin, I can find that online right now. If you want to know how many students were sexually assaulted, ill, hurt, or killed on a school-sponsored program by the University of Wisconsin, that information is sorely lacking. Additionally, when students choose to study abroad, there are many different ways to do that. They may choose to go abroad with the Study Abroad Office at the University of Wisconsin, which has a really prominent, wonderful safety and security director who is highly credentialed. Or you may be at a college within the University of Wisconsin that mandates their own study abroad that doesn't use the Study Abroad Office and all those great resources. Or a professor might decide to do a cultural immersion program in Peru and go on his own. I find this one to be the most risky because there aren't any mandated skill sets for that professor to have before he chaperones students into foreign countries. There's no rule, for an example, of what the student-to-faculty ratio is. And so over the course of many years and many fatalities, we've talked to hundreds of families and said what should and could be done to give these kids the world and help them to prepare to step into their future independently and make informed decisions. And here's an example. If I could share a story about students going to Rome to John Cabot, and I said, you know, I don't want to read about you in the Tiber River. What's your solution? How are you going to depart smart and not drink stupid? You know, you have to wise up over there. It's a different country, different laws. And the students did something really cool and awesome. They put together a Snapchat video for me of a hand with hand puppets. And they said, yo, Mama Hill, 5 of us are going to go out. 2 of us are going to remain sober. And they did the Boy Scout promise. 3 of us will drink, but we promise we will never leave our friends alone at the bar, on the sidewalk, in the bathroom, a taxi, or the dorm. We're going to guard their drinks, and we're going to guard their levels. And if we need to use a breath analyzing computer, we will, but we want to have a good time and stay safe. Peace out. And they called me back and said, nothing happened to us on our trip, but it happened all around us because we grouped together. And I realized that, you know, when you're abroad, you're meeting new people, you don't really know people, but it's very important to connect with expats and create a circle of trust so that you can group together and stay safe.
So is that part of the secret, that the students take it on themselves, create a kind of a safety network like you described, instead of relying on structural safety nets from maybe a university?
In my opinion, and in my son's case, it's very personal for me, you can have a program or a company or an employer who may be able to protect you for a trip, but they cannot protect you for a lifetime. So that school resource is there to ensure the safety and the efficacy and really the academic validity of that study abroad program. But when that student decides to go on spring break, those resources aren't there and they are not self-reliant. And I want, we are creating right now, if you go to departsmart.org, you can download a travel safety checklist with more than 50 touch points we should all consider before going abroad. I have a 10-point quiz that fewer than 5% can pass. I can give it to your audience if you'd like. But we are right now trying to build an online certification course of an action plan that gives tactical strategies, tools, and resources to help us have safe journeys when we go abroad.
We're talking with Cheryl Hill right now of Depart Smart, talking about safety for students who are studying abroad and for Americans traveling abroad. And Cheryl, you mentioned a checklist on your website, some things that we should know. And short of the quiz, I don't want to take the time to do that right now, but can you tell us some of the top items that we need to know to stay safe, both for students and for travelers?
Absolutely. Most of us are not aware that our Foreign Affairs Office has a very prolific site called travel.state.gov that puts forth country-specific travel alerts and warnings and country-specific information on threats to your health and safety. For an example, if you are going to Costa Rica, there is a warning on there that United States employees are not allowed to spend the night in downtown San Jose because it is dangerous. So a student who would be enticed into Costa Rica and to San Jose might read that and say, you know what? If United States employees aren't allowed to go there, I don't think I'm going to be going there either. And if we followed more of this protocol, I don't think students would be duped into programs that are not trustworthy, where they become, in some cases, labor trafficked on internships that are sweatshops. There are some sad stories out there that, you know, we want to talk about the joy of the journey and the exciting opportunities and really stacking those opportunities up for students that are good. So going to travel.state.gov, checklist number one, understanding how to register your trip in the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program, that is step.state.gov. Your United States consulate cannot help you if they don't know where you are or how to get in touch with you, specifically to inform you about risks to your safety like civil unrest, disease, natural disaster, or terrorism.
So you can just log in and tell this website where you're going and someone will track you if you run into trouble?
Twice when I was overseas, I received alerts from the State Department alerting me that Osama bin Laden had been killed and not to celebrate, to maintain a low profile, and if I wanted to go home early, they would assist me. When I was in Australia, I received another alert. There are riots in London. We'd like to reroute you through Amsterdam. Absolutely, but they cannot help you if you don't register your trip. It takes 3 to 5 minutes. Your emergency contacts, when you register, have to have passports good beyond 6 months of your return date. I almost could not get to my son because my passport was only valid for 6 weeks beyond his return.
You had one more?
I was also going to say that parents, especially of 18-year-olds, need to have powers of attorney because FERPA and HIPAA laws may prevent schools from talking or assisting the parent in finding out information about the student if they're hurt. The biggest thing that we all need to do before we go abroad is make sure we're insured. Most students are cash-strapped and underinsured. These trips can cost the equivalent of a semester abroad. And even if you're just a traveler, you know, and you're spending a couple thousand dollars to have a great vacay, it can cost more than $50,000 to bring you home if you are hurt or injured. And if you do not have money to repatriate the remains of someone you love, they will be interred in the foreign country. Insurance is there for the probability of an eventuality. It's a small thing to do to make sure that you have peace of mind.
Cheryl, I'm assuming that is not something that's included on the typical policy. So do you have to go to your agent and ask for something particular to travel?
In our travel safety checklist, we'd like for every traveler, not just students, to consider specific risks in that country. For an example, if you're going to a country that might have tsunami warnings, you might want to have natural disaster evacuation. You're not hurt, you're not killed, but something bad happened, there's no fresh water, cholera is everywhere, and I want out of here. So you need to really kind of do your homework and determine what travel insurance providers fulfill the need of where you're going for illness, injury, natural disaster, civil unrest, death, ransom insurance. You know, some countries do petty ransom. They'll take you and say, give me all your credit cards. And when those are spent, they'll call your family and they want some more money, but they'll release you pretty much unharmed if they get the money that they need. You know, there's also trip cancellation and lost or stolen property, bedside assistance. And knowing whether or not the travel insurance company has a translator, my son tried to dial 911 in Japan. The number is 119. Most of us do not know that the emergency number is different in the foreign country. And even if we do, we don't know whether or not we can access it from a cell phone, or how to ask for help and identify our location in the local language, or whether or not we would be arrested for reporting. So that's the kind of information that we can find on the State Department or on the OSAC.gov site. There, if you search OSAC, O-S-A-C, and the city where you're going, you can find detailed information on crime in certain areas.
We're talking to Cheryl Hill of Depart Smart now about safety for students who are studying abroad and for travelers. And we'd like to hear from you. Did you study abroad, and did you make the kind of preparations that our guest is talking about? Did you ever encounter a dangerous situation that you felt either prepared or unprepared for? How do parents measure risk? How did you do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can share your stories and your advice on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Cheryl Hill of Depart Smart. And we want to hear from you about your experience studying abroad. Did you feel safe? Did you feel like your children who maybe went abroad to study, your kids, were prepared for any situations they might encounter, danger situations? Or do you think it is generally pretty safe and maybe we worry too much about this? Call us at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Cheryl, looking at the decision-making process, someone's got a college student who wants to study abroad, and you're the parent, what sorts of conversations should you have with them before they go over?
Well, I would hope that that parent would first go to DepartSmart.org and pre-register for the action plan so that they and their child will be ready to identify and mitigate risks and advocate for themselves. No one else offers a standardized training program to help you really depart smart. And I think that I gave you the travel safety checklist, which are things to consider, but also the reputation of the program. Because there are not any qualifications, and anyone can open up a business to take any student anywhere in the world, and there isn't like rape crisis certification or first responder training required or any prior incident report or background checks mandated for students going with anyone into a foreign country. There are those mandates for students coming here. And you could go to DepartSmart.org and press the advocate button and ask for our policymakers to protect American students going abroad equally as much as foreign students coming here. But some ways to check the reputation of the third-party program, which is another way that students go abroad, if, let's say that, for example, IES or CIEE would be a program that your child was looking at and maybe they wanted to go to Santiago, you could Google online, you know, any type of, or ask an attorney to do a legal research of any lawsuits that were brought against those companies. You could ask your attorney general for any reports about them. You could look at Better Business Bureau complaints. And it's really those, and we all have negative reviews. We don't expect anybody to be perfect. And when bad things happen, we expect companies to step up with grace and grit and do the right thing as if that was their child. But I can tell you in many situations when students have died, very prominent universities have stopped talking, and they have left that family to their own resources to get to their child or bring their child home because they're protecting the institute and they're worried about lawsuits. State universities have immunity, and they're sovereign. They cannot be sued in a civil lawsuit for personal injury or wrongful death, and parents will do that in order to find out what happened to their child. So I think that really vetting out the program, and let's take people to people. People to People had pitched to us with the signature of Mary Jean Eisenhower that they send tens of thousands of students abroad every year. They hadn't had a death in more than 50 years. And yet, the teacher leaders who chaperoned our son into Japan were also on a trip a few years prior where Ian Phillips died, and we were not notified. So it is very, very important. You are trusting the future and the health of your child to someone else, and in my opinion, we need to make sure that those students can self-advocate and get themselves out of trouble in case something happens. There was a situation of one student who reported to us that she was sexually assaulted. She reported it to her school, to her university. The university brought her home, put her on academic probation, put her in anger management, kept her tuition of $18,000, and told her to work through it if she wanted to get her degree. So knowing if you have something that happens to you, like a sexual assault, what type of rape crisis response is available to you in that country, and most countries have something, even India, that is, there's a program right now that actually works on domestic abuse of American citizens abroad. It's important to know what your resources are so that you can get to them, be safe, and return.
Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. It's a passion. I'm obviously passionate about it. I'm looking forward to creating some standards to make sure we all have safe journeys.
That was Cheryl Hill, Executive Director and founder of Depart Smart, and she joined us to talk about safety for students or travelers abroad. And if you'd like to share your story, whether you felt well prepared, whether your student did going abroad, what did you do and how did you make it happen? Well, you can let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. A study by UW-Madison researchers found that parts of the brain that affect academic performance were smaller in children who grew up in very poor households. The findings suggest that efforts to close the state's racial and economic achievement gaps should start early and be directed at raising income levels for poor children. Bridget Bowden has more.
Naya Tunney of Madison is 5 years old, and she loves to read.
I remember T and H and E and N.
She says she reads all the time. She reads at mealtime. She reads to her two-year-old sister. She says it's important to her.
I learn things that my brain will always know.
And Naya might actually be onto something there. A recent study by UW-Madison psychology professor Seth Pollack showed just how important early childhood is to brain development. It showed that there's a direct link between poverty, brain growth, and gaps in test scores later in life. Here's Pollack.
So now we know that that achievement gap in poverty is at least partially explained by slower brain growth attributed to poverty.
Naya's brain is in a critical phase of development, and she's being stimulated in her home where education is a priority. But children who don't have this kind of stimulation, especially kids growing up in poverty, could experience delayed brain development that can significantly harm their educational progress. Pollack's study found that as much as 20% of the gap in test scores of low-income children is explained by developmental lags in the frontal and temporal lobes of the brain. These are the parts that are responsible for learning, attention, memory, comprehension, and more.
In many ways, children living in poverty had profiles that looked like children who were being maltreated, yet they were receiving very good care from their parents.
Children living in households making below $36,000 for a family of four were the most affected. That's about 28% of Wisconsin's kids. Pollack says he hopes to see his findings put into action with programs for kids in early childhood.
The more we understand about the mechanisms being affected by poverty, I think that makes it much more likely that we can take the resources, whatever resources we have, and direct them to interventions that are really targeting the way poverty is affecting children's growth.
One intervention program that's been fairly successful is Reach Out and Read. The program gives books to kids when they visit their doctor for checkups. Francesca Vosh is a nurse practitioner at the Group Health Cooperative Capital Clinic in Madison, one of the 160 or so Reach Out and Read programs in the state. Her patients include kids from families that don't have much access to books.
No matter the age of the child, I always talk about the importance of reading, and in a 4 or 5 year old, I may say, you know, why are these books important? You know, what's good about reading? And we talk about how reading is good for your brain. And
Ed Hubbard studies educational psychology at UW-Madison. He says Pollack's study built on existing science and made new connections.
We already knew about the impact of poverty on brains. We knew about the impact of poverty on education, but to actually put it all together, I think was really critical to move the debate forward.
But he says the growing body of evidence that early childhood poverty can affect achievement later in life means lawmakers need to be doing more. State legislators on both sides of the aisle are beginning to agree that more needs to be done to address early childhood. State Senator Julie Lassa is part of the Legislative Children's Caucus, which launched in April. She says Pollack's research is the proof they needed to take action.
To me, there shouldn't be any more arguing about the science. So now that we have this research and evidence, what do we do to help tackle the problem?
But she says the caucus doesn't have any specific plans to introduce legislation yet. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time.